All right, good morning, everyone. Welcome to week 7, which is effectively the last week, full week of applied statistics. Because in week 8, well, sure, we'll have an exercise on Monday where I'll also talk about the 2016 exam, which I posted. If people want to look what an exam looks like, I hope you see resemblance to the problem set. And I won't be, well, diverging far from that format. And, well, Tuesday, I will simply go through curriculum. And, well, you can ask me anything there. And then Thursday morning, 8 o'clock at the latest, the exam will be posted. And Friday, by 8 o'clock in the evening, 36 hours later, you should have submitted on the exam.ku.dk. So that's what next week looks like. This week, we're going to talk mostly about fitting, but also, I hope, generally about the curriculum. And since by now, all of you should be relatively confident in things like means and widths and so on, that's why last week we had the Atlas test beam exercise, which was mostly about hypothesis testing, right? And thinking about how can I isolate and how can I maybe fit afterwards? What rates do I get? You know, something with real data that actually didn't follow very much distributions that were easy to fit. Of course, you could do it, but well, they weren't. They were made to not be. And so this week, we're going to talk about a little more advanced fitting, because so far we've said, all right, I have a simple function and I want to fit some one-dimensional data that's typically nice. But yeah, apart from that. And then will you provide solutions to last week's exercises? Yes, we will do our utmost to do that. So if not in code, then at least, you know, written answers to all the below. You're welcome, Nicolai. Yeah, so that's the program. And for this week, well, tomorrow is a little special because Gabriel Brammer, whom have been a censor on this course for a few years now, he will be giving a lecture on data pipeline and hopefully also an exercise. And the idea there being that often you start out with dirty, ugly data with all sorts of things, and then you sort it out and clean it up and make selections in, and then you end up with a data set, not unlike the test beam data that you had last week. That's the result of a longer cleanup campaign. So, yeah. And then Friday, we'll talk more about fitting. But let's start on today's lecture. And let me share here with you. Advanced fitting. There we go. So this slide you've seen many times, defining the chi-square. So mostly this is how we want to attack a fitting problem. And I know that, well, if errors are not Gaussian, then suddenly this might not be the way. And when are they not Gaussian? That's in a histogram with low statistics. But if you're given points to fit, then the chi-square is fine. That is, of course, you need to trust the uncertainties. And we've discussed how to interpret p-values and whatnot. And then I showed this example of a chi-square, and this protrudes very much to the idea of you have to give good starting values. For example, for this parameter alpha, it might be that you just give it 0. And well, the fit would think, well, I'm going to take a small step out. I don't know how big a step I'm going to take out. I'm going to take a small step out. And then, oh, I see the chi-square. Well, here it's a likelihood, and actually a likelihood minus the minimum value of the likelihood so that it gets, you know, this likelihood value subtracted, so the scale actually is meaningful. It steps out and sees the likelihood fall and then says, that's great. Let me take another step in that direction. Great, 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 great. And then starts going up and it may even take a big step and that doesn't help. And it jumps and it says, let me just test somewhere else. No, 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 it's worse there. And then it finds this minimum. And that was because you only provided it with a starting value of zero. Let's say you provided it with a starting value of 1.3 or 1.5 because you had an idea that the good solution was around there. Well, then it would most likely find this minimum, which is significantly better. How much better? Well, if we say that there's a 49 difference in likelihood fall, then it's 7 sigma better. Square root of that, right? 1 sigma away was 1 up. 2 sigma away was 4 up. 3 sigma away was 9 up. Repeating that rule by the chi-square and likelihood minima that they're parabolas. So this is a much better solution, but it might not find it. Another thing you could do is to say, well, I'm gonna give the fitting parameter and I have no clue what value it is. But I can do two things. Actually, it's possible also to give Minui the size, the step size. So if you know that alpha is a parameter which is between -5 and 5, then maybe you give it the starting value 0, but you tell it to, in the beginning, make steps of size 1. Because now it's going to make a step here and it's going to say, I went down to step 2. Okay, I went up. Let me try a few values around. And it will try both here and here and say, well, I'm still have a downwards gradient here. So then it gets to test both of them. And another thing is, if alpha is the value that's uncertain or unknown and that is known to have these false minima or local minima, then it's good to start the fit many times with different starting value, or even as done here, this is the result of a scan. And in this scan, you know, I simply said, let me do a fit where I get all the other parameters. It's actually an 11 dimensional fit, but I get all the other parameters in place except alpha. And then I fix alpha to 0 and all of these values. And then you go through it. Yeah, and Jamie asks nicely, don't you assume that you know the kind of shape of this curve, where the minima kind of, or you're supposed to try until you grow an intuition where the local minima are? Well, if it's your core expertise, then most likely you know where the typical minimas are, and from but it's not easy to know. And frankly, in this case, I had no clue here, but I was at least told by the guy from Berkeley that gave me this data that it was tricky and that it had false minima. So at least I knew that. And then I decided to scan it. And then you start seeing a landscape like this. You don't know, but the only thing you know is that the minimas tend to be parabolic, right? That's the, you know, if you go infinitely close, they should be parabolic. So that part you know. And you write, are you not suppressing supposed to maximize the likelihood? Yes. And that is why this is, in fact, -2 times the logarithm of the likelihood, the natural logarithm of the likelihood. But frankly, people tend, including myself at the time, often just write the likelihood. But it is -2 times the logarithm of the likelihood. All right. So those are the pitfalls. And to show you the degree to which this can go wrong, here is a slightly damped harmonic oscillator, right? You can see that it slowly goes down. It doesn't go down around 0 and just goes up and down. And one of the key parameters here is the frequency. Because if you don't give the fit a good starting frequency, then man, you're lost. It's never going to work. And why is that? Well, that's because if you change the frequency ever so little, the fit is completely lost, right? It's going to be okay here, but not okay here, but okay here and not okay here, or something. It's going to be out of tune. And if you do the same thing as I showed before, do a scan of the, so you do the good fit as shown here, but now you say, I'm going to take the frequency parameter and scan it in chi-square. You're going to get a plot like this. And so for all other values than the correct one, you're going to get a chi-square of 40 million, right? And no matter where the damn fit goes, it's going to get a chi-square of 40 million. That's simply in phase some places, out of phase other places. And then when it gets close to a reasonable value, well, it's actually going to suddenly have a sort of an oscillation up and down that gets wilder and wilder until the minimum. So in this case, I did a scan and I did it with, I think, 3,000 values across here. And the best value it found was 9.6, and that gave a chi-square of 30,000. And then, well, at least I know this is not a bad value, because on this scale, 30,000 is quite far down. So here, now you release it, this parameter, with this starting value, and probably if you want to, also giving it, saying, don't jump plus minus one to begin with, right? Jump very little, because I tested all the other values and they're terrible. And then it finds this value and with a tiny, tiny error. And why the small error? Well, that's because when you have things that are oscillating where you get many frequencies in, you can measure it quite accurately. And well, a lower chi-square. We may return to that problem, but this I think is the extreme example of saying, if you don't give it a good starting value, it's never gonna find it. Now, when to use what type of fit? So if you're fitting a set of points, so they have X, Y, and sigma Y, and possibly sigma X, then I'll choose always to do a chi-square fit because it's equivalent to a likelihood, right? The errors are Gaussian, and thus it's optimal in that sense, and it yields a goodness of fit. This essential p-value telling you, is this a good fit or not? It may be the best, but it may not be good. Fitting distributions of values, so that's histograms. Well, here the situation reduces to that above if it's high statistics, right? If there's tons of data in each bin, then things are Gaussian, I'll always do a chi-square fit. Of course, you have to take care of choosing the binning, right? We discussed that last time. And I hope that, please choose a range and a binning that makes sense. And then if the statistics is very small, then the likelihood is preferable. And if possible, you should use the unbinned likelihood. The binned likelihood, you might be forced into that corner in two cases. Either you don't have the unbinned data. Maybe somebody already binned it for you. And that is not unlikely. You have a histogram and you don't know the original data. Or it might be that the data is simply not continuous, but categorical and therefore binned. For example, integers, right? If you're fitting something that's a binomial distribution, well, unbinned is not going to help you. Though it can be done unbinned. But it's very often best to start with a chi-square because it converges better. It's more robust to outliers and so on. Now, what about correlations between parameters? And that's what we're going to talk about today. Well, sometimes two parameters may be very correlated. And how do you see that? Well, the fit gives you not only the values and the uncertainties, but it actually gives you the covariance matrix, right? So if you fit with five parameters, you get a 5x5 matrix out. And the diagonal, that's the errors on the single parameter squared, and it's symmetric, and the off diagonal, that's the correlation. In fact, it's the covariance. Hence, you need to divide by sigma x, sigma Why? To get the row between them. And if the row is, I would even go so far as to say, plus minus 50%. Well, if it's plus minus 15 within that, fine, leave it. If they're plus minus 50%, well, it's probably okay. But sometimes you get parameters that are correlated 99%. And in that case, that means that they represent the same feature in the model. And one should either fix one of them or make a relation between them or rewrite the way you fit. And I would say a classic example is fitting two Gaussians with a common mean. Because in that case, you might say, well, I'm going to take n in front of one Gaussian plus n in front of another Gaussian. And I'm going to put mu to be the same parameter. That's nice. But you will find that n1 and n2 are extremely correlating. Because if one Gaussian does not cover a point, the other is more or less forced to do it, right? If there's 1,000 points in this histogram, then N1 plus N2 must be 1,000. Well, then you could say, can't you just say 1,000 minus N1 or something like that? But a better way of doing it in general, also because it might not be you know the number, it might be that it's a peak on top of a background, typically. Well, in this case, imagine you put n outside and say there's a fraction of one and a fraction of the other. Now n represents the overall number of events in the peak. And then these are the fractions between the two. This works simply better. And you might say, but it's equivalent. Yeah, mathematically. But you know, when you're fitting and with regards to correlation, this is much better down here. But it doesn't mean that things aren't correlated, because sigma 1, sigma 2, and f are still going to be correlated. And maybe if sigma 1 and sigma 2 are very different, then they're not going to be very correlated. But in reality, often they are. And now you might choose several things, because remember, if they're very correlated, it means that they represent the same feature. So now you got three parameters left for what should in fact only be two. You can of course try to run it. There's nothing wrong in fitting with a large correlation, but the larger it is, the more you should question your result. What you can do is, for example, fixing one of the parameters. So it might be you say, look, if I leave it free, then I get around 80% for the fraction of the first one. I'm gonna fix it to 80% and rerun. And now you should see that the chi-square does not get a lot worse. And you might say, but what if it's not 80%? It doesn't matter, because it represents the same feature. It will shift around in sigma 1 and sigma 2 accordingly, because it still is only a two-dimensional problem. And these two can span that problem. Or it might be that you put a relation between the two. You might define sigma 2 to be 3 times sigma 1. In that case, there's still a parameter, one parameter less. And well, then how much should be the wide Gaussian and how much should be the narrow one? You can adjust with the F. It's okay to reduce the number of parameters when they are represent the same feature. All right, global fits. Well, it might be that you have data in several samples and you want to fit them simultaneously. There's nothing wrong in doing that, right? You can do that with one single chi-square where you loop over in sample one and sample two. And typically, and what we'll have in the exercise today is that you have a signal. This is what is really of interest. And then you have a large calibration sample, which also includes some of the parameters of the signal. For example, you might not know the width of the signal. Let's say it's a Gaussian peak. You don't know the width. And of course you can fit it, but it's so uncertain that it makes the fit really uncertain, right? Is there a peak? Is there not a peak? But if next to there's a large peak, tons of statistics from something you know, well, then it's a great calibration sample, because let's say that it has because it's by the same apparatus, the same width. Well, then you might do a simultaneous fit of the two where the width is in common. And since this is a high statistic sample, well, then it gets, if not fixed, then at least very constrained. And the signal fit part of the fit doesn't have to take an uncertainty from the fact that it doesn't know the width very well. This becomes an input. Now, that's one case. There are maybe even simpler ways to do this with so-called chi-square penalty terms. What is that? Well, let's say that you have all your parameters here, and there's one parameter, theta n, which is known. Well, if it's known to be x, then you should, of course, fix it to x. Simple as that. But what if it's known within some uncertainty? And that could be the example from before where you fit it, where this is the width of the peak, and you fitted it on a calibration sample, might only be twice as big or something like that. But hey, you got it here with uncertainty. What can you then do? Well, you can put a penalty term. You can say, well, I define my chi-square as before, but I add a term, which is how many sigmas away is this parameter from what I know that it should be from elsewhere in units of its uncertainty. So there's an extra term here to the chi-square. And if this value decides to be far away from the value known, well, that's not impossible, maybe different, but it's going to cost you in chi-square. So if the data really shows that it should be wider or more narrow, then fine, but there's a penalty. And the great thing is that the penalty for moving, you know, one sigma away or maybe even two is small. But if you move far away, of course, that's expensive in chi-square. And I think the penalty term way of doing it is really nice. Then, well, there's very complicated fitting, and I just want you to see it. Okay. How can one implement this in Minuit? Well, remember that there are two ways of writing your fit. We made that external function because then you don't have to rewrite your chi-square every time. But in this case, remember the other way was to write the chi-square yourself. It's not that complicated. And then ask Minuit just to minimize the chi-square you wrote. In that case, you can just add that term in the chi-square you wrote yourself. I hope that answers your question. All right. Peter asks, let me just read and well, if you simultaneously fit the calibration and the data you're interested in, then don't you get a good p-value due to the calibration data without necessarily fitting the signal fit? Sure, and what you often do then is that you first fit the calibration by itself and then fit the calibration sample and the real data sample. And then you look at how much do I increase the chi-square when I do the new fit with the signal in to get which part is the signal contribution to this. Okay. And the extra term is outside of the sum, Nikolai. Yeah, I don't know how to write that. I put a few small spaces here just to make sure that it's not in the sum, but I agree it's not clear. It's outside the sum. All right, very complicated fitting. Well, sometimes you have several samples. It might be that you have signal and control and validation and background and whatnot. And also, it might be that you have signal one, signal two, signal three, background one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. And suddenly all of these needs parameters. And you do a simultaneous fit of all of this. And believe me, you don't write that fit straight away. I recall the so-called well, fitting for CP violation, which is the difference between how matter and antimatter behaves. This was is represented by the parameter among many. So, well, not many, several. Sine to beta, never mind. Sine to beta was one of the fit parameters. But the total fit had 98 floating parameters applied to 4 data sets. And then I thought, okay, that's going to be, that's big. But a few years later, it was 120 floating parameters on 6 data sets. And then you think, okay, that's a lot. It took, you know, something like half an hour for Minui to converge on these fits. So they were hard and long. You usually can set the range for which you want to minimize the likelihood. Yes, you can. But in this case, it was simply a computational thing. Well, computers A weren't as fast, B it wasn't run in parallel, you had to loop over the data set for every step, and you had to take quite a lot of steps for this fit to converge, because because walking around in a 98 dimensional parameter space is just tough. So what they did typically was to fit the background, fit the control, fit the validation by themselves, and then say, okay, afterwards, these are the input parameters, so that we know that it was good. Okay, Anna, cool. So, however, in the Atlas-Higgs discovery fit, I mean, this was also a fit that developed up to the discovery. But if you look just at the number of data sets that were combined, right, it started with a handful of data sets, and then slowly grew until it was 100 different data sets, all sorts of different data sets. And the number of model components, this was more code technical, but that got really large. And the number of parameters in the likelihood, well, they just kept increasing. So a 600 parameter fit. But notice it never gets into the millions. You know, fitting with millions of parameters, we don't call it a fit anymore, I would say. But this one got really, really advanced. It's the biggest fit I've seen so far. And they were combined in a global likelihood, minimized simultaneously. All right, fitting tips and tricks, well, always give good initial values. I think that's key. Just look at it and try to see what should the parameters be here roughly. And secondly, and we talked about this, if it doesn't work, try to draw the PDF on top until it looks reasonably like the data. Never start an advanced fit. Always start with a simple one and then expand on it. And try to make your parameters as little as correlated as possible. Believe me, it's really hard. You will always have correlations, and they might even be significant, but at least try to minimize this. Also, let the parameters represent the quantity of interest. And what I mean by that is when you were fitting for the acceleration in the project, well, it was nice to put the 1/2 in front in the formula you wrote, because now the fitting parameter was in fact the acceleration and not half or twice the acceleration. In other cases, for example, the length of the vacation from the coffee data, in that case, you wanted the length of the vacation, and you could have gotten different things out, but then you would have to do error propagation on the uncertainty. Minui does that for you in a very good way. So use that by saying, this is the parameter I really want. Can you repeat how you would fit test the correlations of the parameters? Yeah. This comes out from Minui. When Minui converges, it actually has the covariance matrix, which means not just the variance from which it gets the uncertainties on the single parameters, but it has the covariance between the different parameters. And in today's code, I'll show you how you access that, right? It's shown in there. Yeah, yeah. I don't want you to sit and dig into the Minui manual to get covariances and so on. At least I want to show you an example. From then, you can apply it at will. And I think it's also generally a cool thing to show when you do a fit, that you actually looked at the covariance matrix and looked if the correlation were large or not. That's just sort of a small stamp of professionalism. And I think what you will hit, if anything, then it's that others just don't do it. And they might look at you and say, And if you see a dodgy fit, well, I would ask about what does the covariance matrix behind this fit look like? And I suspect that most people won't be able to answer that question. All right, back to the slides. Start with a chi-square fit simply for better convergence. And then if it doesn't check out, well, draw the function on top and see if you can sort of get initial values, check the correlations, and try to fix some of the parameters to reasonable values. And even with all of these things, there's never any guarantee that your fit will work. So that's why fitting is an art. And then in the end, I just want to show a couple of examples of fitting equations and constraints. One example is fitting with a template. So have a look at this. Over here, there's a distribution for which there is no functional form. The only way you can get the distributions here is by simulation. But clearly there's a place where this goes down and we want to know exactly where that is. This is the measurement of the W mass, but never mind what it is. So we simulated, well, what if the mass was 79? What if it was 80? What if it was 81? Oh, and actually I know, well, this is half the mass. So what if it here had sort of the edge parameter at 39, 40, 41, 42. And then you make all of these so-called templates and you have to make sure that they're good. But well, I hope you see that they're reasonably good. And then you actually draw as a function of the template value. And here it was a scale because it was a test of it. You get the chi-square value between the template and the real data. Remember, you can do the chi-square between two histograms. You do that, and lo and behold, that gives a parabola. Because, well, if it's far to the left, it will have a terrible chi-square. And if it's far to the right, it will also have, and somewhere in between is going to be best. So that's a parabola with one minimum. And from that, you can actually fit what that edge parameter is. So you don't have to have a functional expression to make a fit. You can do it with templates, if you can build the templates. And better yet, at some point, you're going to have the good template. And that's going to give you a chi-square value in the difference. And from that, you can test if the best template actually matches the data. Because if it doesn't, well, this is going to be an awful chi-square. It's still going to be a parabola. It's still going to be the best, but it's awful. But in this case, well, it works. How do you obtain the templates in the first place? Well, this is where you have to have a very, very good simulation. So this is done in the Atlas case with a humongous simulation of every little working part of Atlas. So you start by simulating two particles colliding, coming out and decaying and do all sorts of stuff. And then next you will take each particle and go through every millimeter and ask, what's the material? Does it decay? Does it hit anything? And then maybe it hits something, becomes five particles. Well, then you take each of these a millimeter out. And then they deposit energy. And then you have something that says, what does the electronic read out when you deposit this much energy? So all the electronics is also simulated. And in the end, you apply the reconstruction algorithms to this simulated data that looks exactly like the, well, not exactly, but to a very high degree, like the real data. And then you build these templates. It's not an easy thing to do, but sometimes you have no choice. All right. Another example is Corona. So a model of the of an epidemic. Well, the simplest model is a SEER model: susceptible, infected, and recovered. SIR. And an expansion that gets more, I would say, realistic is a SIRE model, where you have an exposed phase and an infected phase. So you get infected here, but you're not infectious yourself, you're just exposed. And then you get into an infected phase, and then you go out. And the good thing about that is that each of these can be exponential, but it doesn't end up being an exponential, it ends up being a more reasonable state. And well, here is such a model written up. I just wanted you to see that it's not a classic function, right? There's a whole little simulation of a world and a loop underneath that is the model. In the same way, this could be a model of the universe, and you were sort of fitting cosmological parameters. And then you look at data, and where do you have an epidemic that runs? Well, we have one now, but a specific case was actually in Aarhus in early August, where, well, the as you can see, it was a very low level of infection, and suddenly it rose. And well, you have to scale the data in order to get something, but well, imagine that you don't see beyond this point. The blue curve is this model where the infection rate is constant. And then it becomes an exponential, and that's the blue curve. And that's a fit to this data. And in the question, when does the curve change? Well, you can just include one more data point at a time and ask, for how long can I uphold the hypothesis that this is exponentially growing? And the answer is you can, including that point, but when that point comes around, you can't any longer. The p-value of that becomes small. Well, then you know that at some point, the rate at which people got infected changed. And you can say to the fit, well, now you should fit one rate of infection until some day, and then you should switch to another rate of infection at some point. And that is what the next one is. But as you can see, it's highly uncertain. And then you include one more day, and well, it's still highly uncertain. And why is the error bar increasing with higher value in general? Well, in general, the error goes like square root n, right? So if you 10 double the number, well, then you 3 double the size of the error. Of course, the relative error is smaller on that point than it is on that point, because this point is very close to zero. So the relative error is large here, but the absolute error goes up like square root of n. Yeah? Agree, Lars, or? All right, I hope. Otherwise, please complain if that's not clear. That's okay. You're welcome to argue. All right, now including one more data point. Oof. When you get this reading back, then you can see, all right, it stopped. Things went down. And this was the case of Aarhus. What is also interesting is that the day that there was a central lockdown in Aarhus was this day, the 7th of August. And, you know, if you were a politician, you would go out with a tweet the next day and say, hey, look, our lockdown worked. The next day, you know, there was a lot fewer cases and it's going down. But what really happened was that if you fit this, then if you allow beta to change at some point, then the point at which it wants to change is actually this day, on the 1st of August. And this is when there was a public reaction, because once you publish numbers this size, especially early on, people were a little, I am gonna cancel my date or whatever I had of plans. And the uncertainty in this is about plus minus one day, a little less. But that means it might also be a reaction to this point, or some started at this point. But when this reading came out, people in Aarhus started canceling what they were doing. And then, whoopsie, it turns. Yeah. So that was a case of that. And then a case of sort of a large fit that works nicely. It's again from particle physics, where in the Atlas detector, the Z particle will decay to two muons that we see flying out. And they bend in the magnetic field. And the question is, do we measure the momentum of these correctly? And why shouldn't we? Well, it might be that in some directions we measure too high a momentum, and in others we measure too low a momentum. And here's a whole list of things that can go wrong, you could say. I don't want to run into that. But the nice thing is that you can constrain that, because you can say, well, as a function of direction for one of the muons and the other muon, you can ask, well, in this point, so for a very specific direction in one direction and the other, what mass do I get out for the Z, which is known, in data and in Monte Carlo? And if I don't get the right mass out, well, that's because we're measuring momentum wrong. The problem being that you don't know if it's one muon on average, or the other muon, or some combination of the two, which is at fault when you don't measure the right value. But you do get a constraint here, right? You get one constraint from measuring this difference. And well, how many do you have in total? Well, if you had infinite statistics, you would have 576 constraints. How many parameters would you need? Well, you would need one parameter to say, well, if you're a muon here, you should multiply your momentum by 1.001, for example. And the same over here. So since there are 25 bins here, 24 bins here, and 24 bins here, well, that means that you need 48 parameters. So you have 576 constraints and 48 parameters. Well, unfortunately, you don't have you don't fill statistics in all. So you look and at the difference also in data and Monte Carlo. And again, plot things so you see the differences. But in the end, that's an over-constrained system where the constraints have uncertainty, and you minimize that in a chi-square. So here's what the chi-square looks like, but it's, you know, it's running over a data file like this saying, what should I multiply with to get this close as possible to one? And then you look at what you get and you see that the values are not zero. I made it such that, you know, it's one plus some value you have to multiply with. It's not that. And there are actually two parameters you need to multiply with. And you clearly see a pattern in this. And then you minimize it with a chi-square. You get all the correction parameters and then you plot it after corrections. And lo and behold, it worked. Now you have a better detector. So I hope that was an overview of what the chi-square can do for you, also through examples. And it takes a while before, I mean, it needs playing around. And often if you, you have to recognize the problem, right? You have to recognize that it's an over-constrained system, that you have more equations than you have free parameters, and you have uncertainties in. And it was that original problem that Carl Friedrich Gauss with the least squared method solved, and Ceres was discovered. And it has just, people have realized through the ages over and over again, how smart it is that you can take the uncertainties into account and minimize with respect to all the parameters you want, and get those out with uncertainties and with correlations through a chi-square fit. and it will even tell you if it describes the situation well through the p-value. All right, Peter asks, could you say a bit about the parabola shape of the chi-square value and what it could be used to say? Yeah, I'm just going to take this one. I hope that's okay, Peter. So from simply when you minimize a chi-square or a likelihood, minus 2 times the natural log likelihood, then you should expect that around the minimum, it will be a parabola. It may look ugly. In some cases, it does. But around the minimum, it's a parabola. Sometimes it's a sort of skewed parabola. That's because if things are not Gaussian, then you won't necessarily get a perfect parabola. But man, you have to dig hard to get problems which do not give you a parabola at the bottom. And then it may look like shit elsewhere. Sorry. And well, the reason why I wanted the other plot was because it had good values on the axis here. And now you ask, well, you find, where's my minimum? That defines the best value of the parameter you have here. And then as you walk out one side, when you get to the point where the chi-square or the change in likelihood from the bottom increases by 1, well, that's where you get the uncertainties from, right? So when it increases by 1, that's 1 sigma away. Well, since it's a parabola, then if you go 2 sigma away, it of course have increased by 4, 3 sigma, 9. And if things are Gaussian, that rule is perfect. If things are not Gaussian, well, then it will not be perfectly so. But you see in this case, and where did that come from? Okay. Well, that comes from theoretical statistics. So that's, that is the, well, sort of the basis. And I'm thinking, can I sketch a simple proof of that here? No, I don't think I'm going to attempt that. If please tell me if that's sort of a necessary thing. And this is the type of feedback you are also very welcome to write in the course evaluation. That gives me the chance to see it in writing and saying, you know what, if that's the central thing, how about I find a proof and write it up in an explained way and either put a link to it or something else. All right. How is it that the errors on a parameter is calculated by Minui? I remember that it was the chi-square represented with respect to the minimum value. But how is that really happening in Minui? Well, Minui does exactly the tracing out of the parabola at the bottom of the minimum. And then it asks, how far do I need to stray out before my chi-square or likelihood, minus 2 log likelihood, increases by 1? And let's say that this was a fit in 2 dimensions, right? Then you would have sort of a 2-dimensional parabola and it would do the same thing. But in 2 dimensions, you might get not a circle at the bottom, but an oval that shows the correlation between the 2 parameters. And that's how it gets the covariance matrix. And when you do a fit with 10 parameters or something, well, then it does the 10-dimensional parabolic minimum and all the covariance between the different ones numerically and feeds that back to you. And that is why you shouldn't write a fit yourself, because getting that out is really hard. Did that answer, Peter? Sorry, Nikolai, I hope that answers the question on how it gets the error. Cool. In the problem set, there was a question about how much data you would need to get a certain error on your parameter. How do you figure that out? You can take that when you get to it in the course. Yeah. Well, I'm going to talk about that a lot on Friday, but because it's so central, let me just also say it here. So this parabola represents the data at hand. if you were to four double the amount of data, then you should see the parabola shrink and become a much more steeply rising parameter. And as it happens, and again, can be shown by proof, then the amount you should stray to the side before the chi-square goes one up becomes half of that. So that is how, by increasing the statistics, that the parabola shrinks. And that means that if, for example, and I remember the question very well, Peter, if you measure something plus minus one, and you need an error of plus minus 0.1, so 1/10, well, then it's very simple. You know that the uncertainty is going to reduce with square root n. And so you would need 100 times the data to get it that well. Yeah, so the error decreases with square root n. And I think that was the top number one thing on the top 10, that errors decrease with square root of n with data. So yeah, but we're going to return to the top 10 and see they all make sense on Tuesday. Next Tuesday. Tomorrow is Gabriel who's on. Cool. Today's exercise, which I'm going to end with, talking about, well, let me stop sharing here and quickly jump to it. Here. Well, there are two parts of the exercise. One is also getting rid of correlations and sort of fit with two functions that look alike. And that's always the problem, because then the parameters are correlated. But here there's some data. It looks like there's some background and there is a signal here. And maybe something happening over here, but that's not quite clear. And well, I want you to make a fit of this. And it tries, and this is what it gets. Probably you didn't give it good input parameters. And, well, quantify that peak, and then go search if there are other peaks, assuming they're the same width. And then we also do a fit of an exponential. Well, in fact, a double exponential. If the exponential, if a double exponential is a steeply falling, and then, you know, a long one here, then they're not that correlated. But when the lifetime of the two becomes, well, comparable, and that's within a factor of two, then suddenly, well, should I take a little more of one of them or the other? Well, they become very correlated, and that's problematic. And well, that's today's exercise. But let's have a break first and relax until at least 10:30. And well, I'm simply going to stay on this channel. So you're welcome to ask me all sorts of questions, also just blurring out. But please make sure, stretch your legs, and nothing important is going to be said until 10:30. And if somebody says something important, it's going to be repeated at 10:30. Cool. See you around.